best to leave it in its pretty form.
QSL, QSL. Oh, I forgot what I wanted to say. Yeah, for batteries, there are some humidity indicators, humidity hygrometer, On the bottom, it's humidity, and on the top is the temperature. And there are three of them, three different ones. And they all have a battery that stays on all the time. I'm wondering how long these will last.
Usually these things have old styles, the liquid crystal displays. They're kind of a grayish screen. They're very efficient. You just need an ever so slight charge differential on the electrodes that are transparent, and it rotates the polarization angle of the liquid crystal display and gives you the num. The circuitry and the detector are very efficient by design. Usually, I found those types of devices to last sometimes as long as a year, year and a half. You can get a bad battery, and it's a lot shorter, but they can go a surprisingly long amount because of the negligible current that they draw.
What about the battery in your phone? You say that you have a certain battery health, that your battery is 100%, your battery is 90%, and the battery in your phone, and you have to charge it every day, and maybe you get 6 or 7 years of good battery health.
Well, sometimes you do, sometimes you don't. It sort of depends on how you treat the battery, how many times you're cycling it, how quickly you're charging and discharging it, because heat ages a liquid lithium-ion battery. You know, it's different with cell phones because there's an enormous amount of power you're utilizing. You know, these organic light-emitting diodes or these entire screens of active TFT liquid crystal displays, all those things draw a lot of current. And the computer inside most cell phones draws current, and you have a transmitter, you have a receiver, they have multiple. You have a cell phone transceiver, you have Bluetooth transceiver, you have a Wi-Fi transceiver. So there's all kinds of things going on in a cell phone that thankfully isn't going on in those little hygrometer displays.
KG2RY. Do you know about these phones that have solar charging?
I've heard of them. They're usually not very useful. Again, it sort of depends upon what you're connecting it to. I have a watch that is solar powered, and because the watch has relatively little uses little power. An oscillator and a motor, because it's a quartz, it can get by on a small solar cell. But, you know, if you're going to do significant amount of things on your cell phone, the amount of surface area is probably usually not sufficient to charge up. You know, you have to kind of bake it in the sun all day in order to have a full day's charge. So I think it's more of a gimmick than anything.
QSL. Yeah, I'm waiting to hear more about that. Solar charging. And I don't know. I find a lot of times when I put in a system update, and it's not that exciting, but the security is good.
Okay. If it works for you, then it's good for you.
Well, it's hard to measure, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, that's the problem with a lot of things. Especially, you know, we talk a lot about standing wave ratio, but, you know, that's not the only important aspect of antenna use. You know, if we could only measure efficiency, people would only be talking about efficiency, because that's the push comes to shove. That and radiation patterns, because, you know, you could have great, you could have 99% efficiency, but if all of the RF is going straight into the ground, you know, you're not really going to utilize it. So, you know, we talk about what we can measure, and we dream about things that we can't.
Yeah, and how much satisfaction a person can get for making contacts on HF.
Well, again, that's up to the individual. Some people love to do it. Some people don't. Some people are in it for the contest. Others are in it for the wallpaper. Others are interested in fixing broken equipment or getting new stuff to work the way they want it to. Some like to rag chew, like us. You know, there's loads of different routes in this hobby. There's so many different variations on the theme. Dick used to talk about all the different types of amateur radio things to do. And if you don't like the first one, there's the next, you know, 89 to try out. So and some of them are just plain old rag chewing, one human being talking to another human being.
Of course.
Yes, Jim.
Recent conclusion that probably won't be liked by many, but there it is. Some people use radios to talk to people. Other people use people to talk to radios. It's an uncomfortable statement, but there's a whole spectrum of other kind of folks, but those two extremes are here. Or, you know, on the radio. And that's who you're speaking to. It's a little scratchy, itchy, uncomfortable, but it's a thought. Back to Roy.
Yeah, I mean, there are people who talk to other people because they want to do something with their radio, and they want to, quote, play radio, end quote, and that's just a means to an end. But, you know, if both sides of that are happy, so be it. I mean, I kind of get the idea that those type of guys are the ones that you hear on the band talking about what they had for breakfast or the humidity that afternoon or what have you. You know, some might consider it a little on the banal side, but, you know, some people live kind of banal lives and they're happy and content doing that. So whatever floats your boat.
Fair enough. Thanks for the response.
You're welcome. Any other questions, comments, topics for tonight? Feel free. We got about 5 minutes.
KG2RY. Have a nice evening.
Okay, we'll give it one last try. If anyone has any closing comments before we close this particular segment, feel free.
Ham radio is great. It's all word out. You can say something to someone on another part of the world, and it could be very significant. 73KG2RY.
Okay, I'm sure someone is saying some very significant things on HF as we sit here and chat with each other. I wish them good luck, and I hope I hear it myself one of these days. The comments about weather and what the humidity is, and do you remember that candy store on the corner of whatever and whatever else that was around until 1962? I don't know. I mean, nostalgia used to be considered actually a disease. You suffered from nostalgia. You didn't just have it. It was suffering, sort of like a depression. So it seems odd that these days nostalgia is coming on strong. I don't know if it's that the old days were better than the present days. In many ways they were, but they're different. Anyway, any other comments before we close this segment?
I enjoyed the NostalgiaNet with Richie last Wednesday.
Oh, okay. Yeah, the fifth Wednesday of the month when that happens.
So are you saying that nostalgia was a diagnosis?
Yeah, well, I don't know exactly if it was a diagnosis, but it was a disorder. He suffered it.
Very interesting.
Yeah, it's sort of in the same vein that you suffer from homesickness.
Understood. I never heard it presented that way. I'll be scratching my head on that. It's an interesting thought.
Yeah. I mean, the history of medicine and medical disorders can be fascinating. I was a big library fan, so when I was in medical school, I went all over the library. And the very, very top floor of the medical school library had the old books that weren't really in demand, so they kept them out of the way. And I got a couple of books out and read them about fluoridation back in the 50s. You think modern day people with weird stories to tell and conspiracies? You should read up about fluoridation in the 50s. They have nothing on those guys. Matter of fact, unfortunately, Jay Jr. Is sort of bringing back anti-fluoridation nonsense. Anyway, it's a pleasure chatting with you all. I hope you enjoyed this segment, and I hope you'll come back for future segments. But it's coming up to about 10:15, and the time for Paul, WS2N, for the SpaceNet report.
Oh, okay. Thanks, Roy. I like the guitar topic. I had an Epiphone guitar as a kid. And put a magnetic pickup in there. Hooked up to an amplifier. Many, many, many decades. And it worked great. Of course, it was steel string. Anyway, let me drop it. This is Paul WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. And, we'll go through a few of these topics. First story I had, not a good one, because a great astronaut Lowell, Jim Lowell, died at 97 years old. And that was just reported in the news. Heard that yesterday, and of course he was famous for Apollo 13. He was the commander on that, and the news is focusing on that story. You know, you have a problem, which is not what he said. It was Houston, we had a problem, but they were supposed to land on the moon. And Fred Hayes and Schweigert were supposed to be the third craft to actually land on the moon. They would have been number five and six to the moon. Schweigert was going to stay behind in the capsule in orbit. Meanwhile, Hayes and Lowell was going to walk on the moon. Of course, that never happened because the oxygen tank blew. And one thing led to another. Lack of power, lack of unable to keep the heaters on, tending to 10 degree. All kinds of problems with getting back the engine. Of course, they were afraid to fire that. they thought that they might really blow something else, you know, something up in doing that. They wanted to use that to accelerate themselves to come home. And they wound up using the descent engine on the LEM, which was built here on Long Island. And that was to accelerate them even faster. You know, what they had to do is they had to do a figure eight around the moon. That was by design. If you flew out to the moon, all the flights except for Apollo 17 was designed like that, where if you had a problem, you weren't going to be able to complete your mission, you would go into the front side of the moon, it would create a figure eight, and you would come back that way. You know, automatic return. But because they needed to get back quick, like lack of heat and all, what they wanted to do is accelerate after they had gone back to the moon, and they couldn't use the service module engine because that blew. They used the descent engine, and off they went, and cut back the amount of time that, you know, for the return trip. They wound up successfully landing in the Pacific Ocean, and that was it. They really, you know, put their names in the history book. But Jim Lovell, that was his fourth flight. He had three other previous flights. You know, he started off with Gemini 7, him and Frank Borman went up in that. And that was to prove out a long duration mission. You know, would they be able to spend enough time in an enclosed space in a spacecraft like they would need to do for Apollo? They needed to know, well, needed at least 10 days to do that. So for Gemini 7, they figured, well, we'll do 2 weeks. So all they do is orbit the Earth for 2 weeks, and they got to get out of their space suits, you know, their flight suits going up, which was a first for that time frame. They did not do any EVAs, but they stayed in there and they ate, and eventually they slept. Days ticked by. It was a very good long duration flight. The interesting thing about that flight was they became a target for Gemini 6, Stafford and Sherrar. You know, what happened was 6 was supposed to go up, and that was delayed because the idea of 6 was to dock with the Agena spacecraft. The Agena spacecraft was supposed to take off from Earth and go into orbit. It had a docking collar on it. And that flight did not work out. So, you know, they couldn't get another Agena ready anytime soon. They were pushing. You know, it was go fever. They needed to complete a docking. So, or at least a rendezvous. So they were supposed to rendezvous with the Agena, and that couldn't happen. But because number 7 with Lowell and Boeing, Frank Borman was going up, they decided, well, we'll use that as a target. We'll try to rendezvous with it. So because of that, Gemini 7 actually took off and flew before Gemini 6. Okay, so now they make it to orbit, and a couple of days tick by, and sure enough, number 6 would stop at Sherrar launch, and they eventually, they don't dock. You know, a rendezvous, going close up to one another, And they got what they got, was accomplished. And that was such a big deal. You know, they had beautiful photographs. I remember as a kid, you know, Life magazine was very popular. And they, Life magazine always had space pictures. And that was probably some of the best pictures that ever came back, was those two spacecraft, you know, looking at one another in orbit. So, yeah, they did good. And then he did have another flight as well on Gemini. Gemini had, you know, flights. They had flights Gemini 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, all the way up to 12. And Jim Lowell went up on number 12. He was the commander. And at the time, they wanted to send somebody new up there with them. That was usually what they would do. They would have an experienced guy, since he had gone up on 7. He was the experienced guy, so he became the commander. They needed a pilot. And so the new guy was Buzz Aldrin. So, you know, he was one of these guys that was really an expert in designing systems on how to not only dock, but how to move around on EVAs. Previous flights on Gemini, they had a lot of trouble with all the EVAs. But Buzz Aldrin, he had the answer. He studied this stuff inside and out when he was younger until flight. So they go up, and sure enough, first thing they did was able to dock with the Ingenious spacecraft. They proved they could do that successfully. Then Buzz Aldrin eventually did a spacewalk, and one of the spacewalks lasted over 5 hours. So they proved that, you know, the spacesuits would work, they had the capability of maneuvering in EVA, which needed to be done for future flights and eventually on the moon. And that turned out to be very successful. Of course, that was the final flight, and really put a ribbon on the Gemini program. One other flight he went on was, Jim Lovell went up with Apollo 8. Apollo 8 was not a mission that was going to land on the moon. That was a mission where they wanted to see if they could orbit the moon. And they did that. It was launched right around Christmas time. In fact, they went into orbit around the moon for Christmas. And that's where they write off, from the book of Genesis. And they took a little heat for that. The atheists didn't like that idea. But anyway, that's what they three of them, again, it was Baum and Lowell. And then they were able to prove that, they could launch on a Saturn V rocket, which they've launched a bunch of them, but never with a crew. They had different versions of the Saturn rocket, but not a full blown one like this. So they proved that they could launch on the Saturn V, eventually go into orbit, and successfully, they put their rockets, in proper orientation, and actually did, 10 orbits around the moon, and that rocket had to refire again to get them out of lunar orbit. That didn't fire. They still were going around, I guess, in orbit. And it all worked out, and they wound up successfully coming back. And to a hero's welcome, first people actually to orbit the moon. Anyway, that's Jim Lowell's, Lovell's story. Any comments? WS2M. nothing heard. There's a telescope called the Atlas. There's a couple of them around. They're at different locations. And the one in Hawaii recently picked up an interstellar visitor. So it's a comet. Seems to come out of nowhere. Traveling 130,000 miles per hour, which is much too fast for a regular comet or asteroid. If something's going that fast, they know it must have come from outside of our solar system. You know, they knew that is much faster for, it's faster than the escape velocity of the sun. So they don't want to pass the sun. It's not going to go into orbit around the sun. So for that to have happened, it must be, it must be from outside the solar system. So they named 3I Atlas. And they got the name Atlas because of the telescope that discovered it in Hawaii. And the way these Atlas telescopes work is they look at the sky at night and they take pictures, a lot of pictures. One night they'll take 1,000 pictures. And they'll actually scan the whole sky for the night. And they'll scan the whole sky around 4 different times, during the night. So you have 4 sets of pictures for every part of the sky for one night, because they do 1,000 pictures. And they review the pictures afterwards, and they look at the background stars, and they see a little light. If that light moves within the certain area, they'll say, that could be a comet or an asteroid. And in fact, the name of the telescope Atlas is called the Asteroid Terrestrial Impact Last Alert System. So they're looking for anything that moves. So they'll compare, 4 pictures in one night, and the one little light was there, and now it's there, and now it's there in the background stars. So let's investigate that, and they'll look further into it. They'll pass the information on to JPL or the European counterpart, and they'll investigate what they're looking at to see what it is. Sure enough, this thing came up as an interstellar traveler. So since there were, since the beginning, we're getting better at looking at these things. But, as far as the astronomy community is concerned, there's only been 2 previous interstellar objects. One in 2017, and then one in 2019. And this would be the third. So they call it 3I Atlas. Now, if you watch the news, they're not paying attention to that letter I, and they're all calling it 31 Atlas. So that, which is that's how this particular object got its name, 3I Atlas. That kind of thing happens with a supernova too. There's IA supernovas out there, and they look like, it looks like a 1A, people call it 1A, 1A supernova. And, just the way the news media prints some of this stuff, I thought I'd bring this up. Not only that, I think it's an interesting system. The new telescope we talked about recently also has this kind of a system, but that's a massive telescope. That's the one that's just opened up down in Chile. So Roman is going to be dealing with the telescope. I'll think of it. This WS2N for ID for the SpaceNet report. Okay, anyway, nothing heard. Launch. By a Vulcan Centaur rocket built by ULA, United Launch Alliance, and that should be going up actually in a couple of days. It should go up Tuesday, you know, unless it's bad weather or something, from Florida. The mission is for the United States Space Force, actually, to put up this this satellite to geosynchronous orbit. Now, you know, we have a lot of large satellites that have gone up there to that orbit. When you want to put one there and get it there in a hurry, you don't need to have all these ion thruster engines like a lot of them do today. Otherwise, you could put it up with an average rocket, you know, a Falcon 9, and then, you know, take a couple of months to physically get it to the geosynchronous orbit. Falcon 9 wouldn't be able to put a very heavy satellite into that orbit, you know. This one is very big, very heavy. So they wanted a direct shot to geosynchronous orbit 23,000 miles above the Earth. So they signed up with the Vulcan Centaur. ULA has launched two of these so far, very successfully. And the first one, they were sending a lander to the moon. And what they're going to do is, you know, they also launch a second one. Now, this will be the third launch. But they're running for engines. They have the booster engines. There's two engines that push Vulcan up, and they're made by Blue Origin. These are 550,000-pound thrust engines. Well, actually, there's two of them, so it's over 1 million pounds of thrust. They are going to put, I believe that they are going to put four boosters onto Vulcan as well, so that each one of those is over 500,000. You're looking at, you know, over 3 million pounds of thrust put this heavy government satellite into geosynchronous orbit. So, you know, it's going to be a big plus for ULA, and it's a big plus for Blue Origin. So far they launched two of their rockets, so that's four engines that went up perfectly, and this will be two more. They also launched their own new Glenn rocket a while back, and that's... Really? Okay. Time out canceled. Anyway, this is a good test for, you know, for Blue Origin's these are called BE-4 engines, and they run on methane, so that's the new fuel that a lot of companies want to run with. Expensive, cleaner, set up for reuse, because now, according to Tory Bruno, he's CEO of ULA, they are planning now to eventually use or reuse these engines to actually get them back in one piece and fly them over and over again. So, if you have clean fuel like methane compared to what the Falcon 9 runs, which is RP1, which is refined kerosene. I mean, it's good, but it's not as good as clean as the methane engines. So there you go. Any questions for this topic or any other topic? WS2S.
WB2BX, did you cover Starship 10 yet?
Hi, Frank. I haven't mentioned Starship yet. And I don't know if they're going to go anytime soon. I heard they brought Starship out. They were eventually going to attach it to the heavy lift booster, but then they said they brought it back to the bay, and so I haven't gotten an update since, I don't know, 4 or 5 days ago. Back to you, Frank.
Yeah, it sounds like we saw the same YouTube update. I think Marcus House ran that and a couple of other people ran that. Yeah, I know you feel he's a shill for SpaceX, and that may be a valid point, but that sounds about right. I think they wanted to go with Starship 10 this month, and now it's apparently they're not going to make it because they, for one reason or other, they've decided they're not ready yet. Go ahead.
Yeah, okay. I pretty much look through this stuff every day, and I haven't seen any updates in a couple of days. But, you have, I think they have like 11,000 people that work for that company. I'm sure they all got their fingers crossed, trying to, at least one, complete success. They set out to do a bunch of things every time they put one of these things up there. Catching the booster, getting the Starship itself to come down vertically properly in the Indian Ocean near Australia. They would like to be able to relight one of their engines. That's very important, to do that, at least one engine. In space, they haven't done that yet. They need to do that to, Frank, but they need to do that to deorbit the Starship itself at a certain location. If they put one of these things in orbit, for days at a time, they need that, they can get it out of orbit. They don't want this 230-foot long, 27 feet in diameter thing floating around up there until the cows come home. They need to be able to fire that engine and slow it down and then deorbit it. So I think that's an important milestone. Hope they get that done someday. And then the satellites. They're looking to put up, not only their own satellites, which are countless Starlink satellites, but other companies, other people that need to put these things into orbit. They tried it I think twice so far, and they couldn't get the door open. They wanted to last time they were going to put a simulated satellite into orbit. And that never happened. They can't get the door open. So a lot of milestones they have before us. And in order to get there sooner or later, you know, I don't think they're going to run out of money. Any comments?
Yeah, well, how many Falcon 9s did they blow up before that worked? And I think this program is turning out to be just like Falcon Heavy turned out to be, a lot more complex than Elon expected. Starship, we call Starship the Next Generation, I guess, is turning out to be even more complex than Falcon 9 or Falcon 27, otherwise known as Falcon Heavy. Extremely, but anyway, they overcame the engineering challenges on both of those, so it's a pretty good bet they'll do this one also, as long as Elon doesn't self-destruct. Go ahead.
Yeah. I know. I 100% agree, Frank. Falcon Heavy, I remember when that first came out. Well, they were 5 years behind schedule. They wanted to first launch in 2013, and they didn't get the Falcon Heavy up until 2018. Originally, they were designing it to actually cruise on board Falcon Heavy, and that never materialized. They gave up with that idea. So yeah, they made some changes. The booster itself, remember the first time they launched it, well, you know, there's three segments on the Heavy, and they thought, well, we'll bring the two boosters forward, starve it back and land it, you know, on land, and we'll have the core stage, you know, go down range and land it on the booster. And that didn't work out. I don't know if it hit the booster or missed the booster, I forget. But then they gave up with that idea entirely. In fact, when they launched the two boosters, have legs, you know, four legs for landing. Either they're going to land on a drone ship or on land back at landing zone, one they call it, and two, which used to be the old launch complex, or launch complex 13. So they took that over from Florida, in Florida as well. And that core stage, they decided, well, let's not even put legs on it anymore. Let's not try to save it. So anytime they launch the Falcon Heavy, that goes into the drink. And I don't know why they never, you know, decided to put legs on it and land it downrange. Unless they thought, you know, they'd have to put that drone ship, you know, maybe past, if they're going to go, let's say, north, you know, past island, where that's about as far as they would normally go. Maybe that booster would come down, you know, on the other side of the globe, and it's just a scratch idea entirely. Anyway, any other comments, Frank, before we go on?
Yeah, I did not realize that the Falcon Heavy is entirely an expendable platform, as they say. That kind of goes against SpaceX philosophy. But I guess that's probably why it just doesn't fly all that much. I think they use it primarily for some of the very heavy Space Force missions, and they've used it for one or two, a couple of commercial things, some very heavy satellites. Anyway, by all means, go on. I don't think I'm really contributing very much useful here. WB2BXF.
Yeah, Frank. Economics changed a lot of things that they were going to do. The second stage, you know what I mean? That has one wrapped around, not wrapped, one Merlin C engine in it. You know, any time the either a Falcon 9 goes up or a Falcon 9 Heavy, there's always that one stage, that final stage that originally they planned on bringing that thing back. There was designs with heat shields and this whole complex piping arrangement. That was all scratched. So all the second stages are now, you know, you orbit them, you know, they do refire the engine again to slow it down and burn them up. Yeah, that was one thing. Also, the spacecraft itself, the Dragon spacecraft, also originally designed was to be a propulsive landing vehicle. You know, they were going to come down with those Draco engines that are, you know, actually, Draco engines are part of it. Even now, you know, if there's an abort, Draco engines fire to get the crew away from the booster. But their plan was to eventually use those Dracos. They were planning on coming through the atmosphere with a, you know, a heat shield. And I don't know if they had a, no, they didn't plan on a parachute at all. And anyway, it would come through the atmosphere vehicle comes, you know, vertically down, propulsive landing. So of course, that was given up early on. But, you know, they make changes. I don't know if it's physics, but you know, economics definitely play a role. You know, I mean, physics. You know, it's not possible to do these things. In fact, Stoke is doing it. Stoke space rocket is being planned on doing exactly that. That's probably a year away or less launching that thing. They have something called the Nova rocket, and that's going to be launched from Florida. They have a launch complex that they're redesigning. That will go up with the Nova first stage. They plan on bringing that thing back, landing vertically. But the second stage also is planned to be returned with a propulsive type of landing. They have this big rocket inside, and then they have 30 rocket chambers surrounding the circumference of the thing. And they plan on coming through the atmosphere with these things lit up, you know, to slow it down, to bring it all the way down to the Earth.
You do so fucked up.
Instead of an ablative heat shield like, you know, like Apollo used or Gemini or Mercury. I mean, this is going to be a reusable heat shield. But to keep it cool, you know, 30 little rocket engines are firing to slow it, you know, slow it down as it comes through the atmosphere. There's, you know, hydrogen fuel, cryogenically cooled fuel. So what they're doing is they have the piping running through the, you know, through the heat shield itself, you know, just actually above the heat shield. So this way they're going to actively cool the heat shield with the, that's actually slowing it down. It's quite a system. I don't know if you saw, there was an interview with this guy. I think that was the everyday astronaut that did that. And they're still, you know, working on it. So we're looking to see how Stoke Space does. That would be a completely reusable vehicle, bringing the second stage back. End of this year, Rocket Lab is still on schedule for bringing an entire vehicle back to Earth. I talked about this one before. And that's a neutron rocket. And that will be launched out of not too far from here in New York. It will be launched from Virginia instead of down in Florida or California. They're building a for the neutron rocket. So that's almost done. And that will go up. First stage, they're going to use engines, they call them Archimedes engines. That's the name Peter Beck chose for the neutron rocket. And then, you know, once it gets into space, the front end, the fairings will open up. All the other flights, you know, there's fairings, they just fly away and expose the vehicle. These things are just going to open up, and what looks like a second stage is going to come out of it, out of the front of it. And that rocket engine, you know, will be attached to the spacecraft permanently, and then put that spacecraft into orbit. The fairings will close up, and now it looks like the whole thing is designed to come back aerodynamically. And, you know, with rocket thrusters and eventually land on a barge as well, you know, similar to what SpaceX does with Falcon. So I thought that was a good design. Any other comments? WS2M. Okay, nothing. All right. I just mentioned one other thing that is talk about putting a nuke on the moon. If you watch the news, like I do all the time, but sure enough, they talked about putting a nuke on the moon. The guy that is running NASA right now, he's acting administrator. That means he's not confirmed by the Senate yet, but, you know, he's officially in charge of NASA. He says, well, we're going to put a nuke on that moon in 2030. Well, there's been a plan to put nuclear power plants of some form on the moon for years now. In fact, back in 2018 on this net, we talked about it quite a bit. And I remember talking to Dick about it. It was something called Krusty Project. It's still active. They're still working on it. You know, eventually you're going to have a base on the moon. You're going to need power. Yeah, you're going to have solar power. You're going to have maybe fuel cells. One thing they'd love to have is some kind of nuclear power, you know, to be comfortable at night and to supply a lot of stuff that they need if you have a small base on the moon. I thought this one system would be great. It's called a killer power reactor using Stirling technology. Another acronym, Krusty experiment. And this thing would put out a total of 10 kilowatts, which would be great. You know, I mean, I have a 4K generator. You know, I could run my whole house. I can't run the big air conditioner. I can run the small one. And the refrigerator. You know, I can run the house. I can run my ham equipment. You know, on 4K. Well, this would be 10, so 2.5 times that amount. And that would be plenty, especially in the beginning for, let's say, a permanent crew of 4 on the moon. And, you know, it's a system where, you know, they're going to run uranium-235 for the core, and that essentially will give off some form of heat. You know, it'll run a Stirling engine. This thing will be going up and down vertically, you know, returning up and down with a coil on it, and that would in turn be producing the electricity. And they plan on putting a couple of these things near the base and tying two or three of these things together and winding up with 10 kilowatts of power, which would be great. But because China, and they're supposed to be working with Russia, and they're going to go up there like yesterday and put up this, you know, that big nuclear power plant, you know, all of a sudden NASA's, you know, jumped on a bandwagon. Okay, we're going to do it. And they're looking to put a hundred kilowatt system up there. Now, this exotic system, which would be good enough, you know, especially for a base in the beginning, to run 10 kilowatts. They've already proven it's safe. Right now it's running. I think they have it running down in Texas somewhere for, it seems like, years on end, to, you know, to actually testing it out. Perfectly good system. That's all they would need. It's a nuke. And yet, oh, no, that's not good enough. All of a sudden they want to put 100 kilowatt system up there, ten times what they're planning on here, and apparently using a different system, actually using a fission and all, which actually didn't work out back in the I think it was the late 60s. Russians put one of those up there, and eventually it failed and wound up crashing across Canada, and they searched for it, and radioactivity all over, you know. I'd have to research that story. Anyway, that one didn't work out. But this system would be good, the Krusty system. But not, you know, not an actual fission.
That time complete.
You know. Anyway, looking at the time. Coming down to the witching hour, so I'm going to turn it back over to Roy. Let me drop it. Thank you. Everybody that listened, and thank Frank for jumping in there. And tonight's Sunday, so tomorrow's Monday. Monday, the Limelight Club always has the club info net. It always starts at 8:30 on these repeaters. And that's always followed by Swap and Chop, and that's always followed by Radio Newsline, which I always like listening to. And I would say 90% of the time, there's always a space story in there somewhere. But now, let me close this part of the Space Night Report for the Tech Net and turn it over to you, Roy. AC2GS, WS2N. Back to you.
Okay, very good, Paul. Thank you. Thank you for the Space Net Report. Thank you for all that you do on the technical net, all that you do for the club. We all appreciate it. And I especially appreciate it. And I appreciate everyone. I hope you learned a few things. I hope you were amused and entertained. And I hope you'll join us the next Sunday night at 8 p.m. when we try and do this all over again. So as always, I want to remind you of some clever words of some clever people. Our own Dick, K2RIW, would always end his technical nets with the advice to be kind to each other, and that's always good advice. Of course, good old Epictetus, it's impossible for a man to learn what he thinks he already knows. So keep your mind open to new ideas, and don't keep them open wide enough that your brain might fall out, because you're really going to need that one of these days. Anyway, stay safe, be well, have fun, and please, if you can, join us next Sunday at 8 when we do this all over again. This is AC2GS, and I will be clear after I say, Slava Ukraini.